This time around, we're joined by David R. Elliott to talk about his latest album, Common Street. We also discuss the importance of small business and the challenges of opening up his own restaurant. Of course, he plays us a few tunes as well. So sit back, sip your poison, and enjoy the ride. I'm Kalen Capson, and this is the Peg and Place Podcast.
I don't know, man. I think music's like the main part of being human, isn't it?
It's a large part of it.
Yeah. Like, it almost, sometimes it feels like it's the whole point. But it's not like, as a musician, I guess, the thing I like about making music and like being involved in music is like there's a tactile craft, but it's sort of implicitly creative. So for that reason, like, I like that there's a way you can learn how to write a song. You can learn the craft and the concept of like putting a song or putting an album together or like recording someone, like, you know what I mean? Like engineering something or even how a mix works. There's so much different craft involved in every element of it. If you want to learn how to play guitar, it's a very, very tactile thing. Mm-hmm. And it feels good to do it. Like your hands feel good to play guitar. And
right.
Singing is the same way. It's like, singing to me is like the most human thing. It sort of transcends language, and it's like, it's the idea of like melody and like the human voice as an instrument just transcends language and like even like every culture ever has like obviously sung, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then once you're like making it, it's this nonstop learning curve of like work, which I like. That's just like how I operate. So the idea of getting into something that you'll never know how all of it works, you know, like I got to a point where I could play guitar well enough that I'd felt okay about it, and that took forever. And like, I like singing's a whole separate thing, and like doing them at the same time, and then singing and playing guitar and writing, that's like three things that you had to like do all this work to get good at, but then you have to figure out how to be good live, which is an entirely other thing. And then that's just like the making the songs part. Once you get into making the records, then it's this whole other thing where you have to learn like what kind, like about types of microphones and how they work and why and when to use what and like, you know what I mean? And to be in a position where you can, like, learning to produce something is a shitload of work. And right, that's still like, you can't even produce without an engineer. And that's a person that has this whole other like endless scope of like skills that they have to have. Cooking is the same way, where like, if you want to learn about cooking every day till you're dead, you can do it. Like, you can learn a new thing every day if you want to. Right.
Right.
I think music's the same way. You know, I feel like if I wasn't opening a business right now, I could definitely spend the next 5 years just learning how to like make a beat well. Like, you know, it's endless. I like the work of it, right?
Yeah.
And it's, the whole point of it is communication, which is nice. The whole point of it is to like be with each other, which I think is another thing that makes it like really just like a basic human thing. It's like, it's a way to be with each other and share with each other in a way that's like objectively positive, you know?
Mm.
Like, unless you're literally making like hate speech music.
That's the first time somebody's worded it that way. Like, yeah. Like attacked what they love about music from the tactile perspective of like,
right,
you know, the analogy of music or of cooking. That's great. And you're right. You could absolutely spend every day learning something new and never hitting an end point of what you can do.
You're never going to wake up one day and be like, well, now I know everything.
Yeah.
I better pick something else. Like, I just like to do a bunch of things, I guess, all the time, but they all have, I feel like they all have like these sort of core similarities that are just like suited to my personality. I like to be busy. I always want to be making stuff. And if I am making stuff, I want it to be difficult. As soon as it's easy to do something, then to me, it's sort of done. Right. That's just how I feel about it. Like, that's always been an issue for me, honestly, like, career-wise. It's like, I don't have the patience to stick to something, really. Like, when I put Rearrange out, you know, a lot of people were like, this is the album that's going to, like, take you to, like, the next place, you know, in your career or whatever. And it did in some ways, right? But a couple months after I was finished that album, you know, I wanted to do some rap music instead. And then, like, you get to a point where you just, like, sometimes I just want to go to work every day and just do my trade. Like, sometimes I just want to cook food and, you know what I mean? And do something that I'm good at, that I've been doing for 15 years and that I can maybe get some money from, as opposed to, like, the art scene. Like, right. I've always been an artist. I'm always going to be an artist. That's just who I am since I was, as long as I can remember, right? But I've always been an artist, but I've also just always been, like, a manual laborer. That's just natural to me, I guess.
You have your fingers in a lot of pots, but you're right. They do kind of all coincide. They're all creative.
Yeah,
you have
definitely.
The love of cooking. You have the love of creating music in various forms, not just. And I understand what you mean about working on David R. Elliott stuff and then wanting to slide into another role for a little while.
Sometimes I just want to sit and write, because the writing is the best part. Writing in the studio.
Yeah.
That's the best part of being a musician to me, always, is like the discovery process and the discipline process of writing a song is very special and unique. Like the combination of it being like disciplined work, but it also being like creative discovery and like narcissism makes it like really fun. Because I guess there are definitely people that would argue that, like, it being undisciplined is really what it should be, or, like, that's the better way to do it. Or, and there's artists that, like, it being undisciplined is the thing. But I would personally argue that, like, at some point, you have to figure out the craft of what you're doing, or you're not going to continue to be good. When you're young, there's so much energy. There's so much creative energy that you're sort of bursting at the seams. And because of that, you can learn a bit. And like, if it's in you, you might get something like really interesting out of it, just from it being so new and exciting, and just having a little bit of the craft, just enough to get down on the page, like, your really good idea, enough that it like translates. You can't do that for every album for 10 years, 20 years. Eventually, you're going to have to figure out why the song was good. Like, the first couple good songs that I wrote, I didn't understand why, like, what happened that made them good. I thought right. It was just like you struck lightning or whatever. But over the years, if you want to continue to be good or improve, then I would argue that you definitely have to, like, learn exactly what you're doing. Like, it's like the best example, actually, is Young Thug. Because the first couple years of Young Thug's, like, sort of prominence, you could tell that he's, like, a genius. Like, you could tell that he's, like, insanely good, but it's so, the output is like constant, and it's just crazy amount of recording all the time that's like completely like throw shit at the wall, see what happens, no discipline, we're just gonna go in studio, get fucking super fucked up, and make a bunch of like great rap music, right? Some years back, I think it was Jimmy Iovine or somebody was like in a meeting with Young Thug, and he was like trying to convince Young Thug to like focus in and like really try on an album. Like, you've done this for a long time, it's gotten you here, but I think the next thing we should do is like you should really like focus in and get a little more disciplined and really try to make the best record you can instead of just recording all day. And Young Thug in the meeting was like, go fuck yourself, I'm gonna do whatever I want. Which I thought was kind of crazy, because to me it just seemed like a guy doing his job, like Jimmy Iovine. I hope that's who it was. For him to be like, from the record label, it would be really nice if you like tried to make like your best album. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's fair to say.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought that was funny, because in 2019, he did that finally. Like, Young Thug, like, he took a year or whatever it was. He was just focused in actually doing this album and like actually like calming down and like working on it. And then it came out and everyone was like, this is Young Thug's best album. This is the best album of the year. Drake said it was the best album of the year. It was so funny, because I was thinking about all the people I talked to that were like, how dare he like try to mess with Young Thug's process? But it was like, he was totally right. Of course he was right. It makes sense. If you were to sit and focus a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and then he made this brilliant album. I think the same thing, like, I think Common Street, like the album I just put out, is the best thing I've done by like a wide margin. And I like the stuff that I made in the last 10 years. I like all of it, pretty much. Everything that I put out. The shit that nobody heard that sucked, obviously, is a different story. But everything that I put out, I like. So I don't know. I think focusing in and like learning how you actually write a song is important over time.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Especially if you're proving that or showing, you know, that you got the skill, you got the know-how, you know what you're doing. And if you're just, it's just spewing out of you uncontained or uncontrolled, it makes sense to try to just focus that and hone it in. And
yeah, I mean, eventually, if you're going to get better, I just think you have to do that. I don't think you can always count on it to be like lightning in a
bottle. That's where a lot of bands fall out too. Like,
yeah,
a lot of bands will put out a great album. The second album isn't as great. The third album, you know?
Yeah.
And then that kills a lot of bands because, like you said, they don't go back and think about what made that great.
That's a theory I have because people talk about this all the time about like why like a first album can be so amazing and then you never get another good one out of them.
Yeah.
And that's my... That's what I would argue. It's a combination of that. I also think that, like, if I lived in a reality where this could happen and I had gotten signed or something when I was like 19 or 20, I might not have put as much work in the following 3 years, like focused in on my talent. If a bunch of people were like, "You're amazing the way you are. Here's all this money." I think that happens to a lot of artists too.
Yeah.
Where it's like somebody tells you that you're done becoming a musician. And like you have to have the like character and like wherewithal to independently be like, "That's not really true. I have to keep working at this if I want to improve." Like you have to have the discipline on your own.
Yeah. You can't think that you're already there. You got to realize you got a long way to go.
But imagine like if you get signed when you're 16, for somebody at that age to like sort of buckle down and focus on their craft and make sure that they improve and like set themselves up in a way that they'll have like a sustainable career. It's a lot to expect.
Where I'm from, you can remember me as the one you are running from. I see the trees dot over me. I'm on a run. I take the one less cheaply now. After work, you can reach out to me. I'm the one you are loving. I see the fall over me. I'm on the run. I see the cracked shingles in the back, scattered on the grass, peeking past my last bottle. I see the last embers in the ash burning in my grasp, shadows on the path, hollow. I see the key reach out for me. I'm on the run. Take your trust more freely now. Alfred, you can reach out to me. I'm the one.
To me, the idea of recording an album and then going out and playing it for a fucking year is just exhausting to me. It's like, by the time the album comes out, I've already been playing it for a year. Depending on the situation, I mean, in the old days, maybe not. When I recorded at home and just did, like, demo-style EPs that I just put out on Bandcamp, you know, I could write and record that in a week for sure. But 9 or 10 songs in a week and or a week or two, if you're, like, focused in and you're fucking 20 and you're bouncing off the walls, like, I can do that. But now it's like, you know, Common Street took 3 years. And it's not like I'm working 40 hours a week on it for 3 years. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm working a full-time job. I got other things on the go.
Right.
But I wrote it for quite a while. I was living in Halifax at the time, and I came home for a weekend just to write. Because the album is so St. John. It's very specific about St. John. And it's the story of some people in St. John, you know. It's very focused in on stories from here. Came home by myself for the weekend and just walked around like a shitload. Had a notebook, and I was just writing sort of ideas down. And then I stayed in a hotel on King Street. And I was just sort of in the hotel alone, sort of looking outside. And like, my point is, like, I was trying to really write it in a really focused way, like in a Randy Newman kind of way. Like,
yeah.
When Randy Newman writes a song, he's not like drunk partying and gets hit by like brilliant idea and then like goes in the studio and like bangs it out. He gets up in the morning and he goes to his office and he writes songs as a job. And they're amazing. Because he's so good at it and he's like disciplined at it and he knows what he's doing. I wanted to write that way because I did years of like getting fucked up to write or just like writing as fast as you can as soon as you have an idea so that the idea doesn't expire before the song's done. And then
right.
I put out a bunch of records where the recording on Bandcamp is the first take, you know, as like when I wrote it. So I don't know. You just, to me, like I wouldn't want to do that forever because you want to get better, right? And then when I started recording it, like I started recording it with a couple people and then switched the people around and then started again and like just stuff like that. I had like a song that I wrote in 2007 or something that I always kept the demo around because I knew there was like a kernel in there that was something. Right, yeah. And it was that, there's that line, it's, I don't know why I've been stuck for so long. There's something about the way he treats me wrong. There's something about like that line and that melody line and the overall sort of structure and melody and key that the song was in. Like, there's something about it that I always kept around. And then when I was writing Common Street, I wanted to write about my grandmother on my dad's side. And that song ended up making a lot of sense. So I rewrote the song around the concept to like sort of fine tune it. My friend Evan came in the studio with me, Evan Matthews, and we started working on it with a full band. And then the files vanished. So we did like all this tape. Like we recorded all this whole song like to tape and then lost it somehow. There was like an accident with the studio. We started over. But when we started over, in that interim period, I had brought in a piano player. So my friend Ev came in to do all this arrangement work with me and like work on stuff in the beginning and set up like some piano arrangements for the album. Like on the song Blue, like he came up with like those like first like sort of piano arrangements for that. And then I had a piano player come in, my friend Jason Keddy, and he came in to do piano. And we had one day where I was like, we should work on this. And my plan was just to work on it with the piano first and then bring the rest of the band in. But when Jason took Evan's arrangement and started playing it in his style, it became like so beautiful. Concurrently at that time, I was sort of coming to the realization that I shouldn't sing it. Because it's about my grandmother and it's sort of in her perspective. And I didn't really feel like, given the context of it, like, because it is about like pretty heavy stuff. And I just felt like given the content, it would be sort of inappropriate to be singing the lyrics.
Mm.
And I had already had Becky doing a bunch of stuff because she's like amazing. So Becky Simon came in to do a bunch of vocals on it. She's like the best part of the album. Like all the best parts are her. But she came in and so I got her working on it. And then the two of them, basically with me producing, we started working on the arrangement for the two of them to do it. Basically, that's a really long way of saying that the album took forever because I was trying to like really do the best thing at all times and like really trying to still follow the path that it gives you. Because I don't think you actually can plan everything. I think you'll end up with something that sounds too planned.
Right. Yeah.
But if you kind of just follow the yellow brick road a little bit, like, yeah. You know what I mean? You lose the file, you know, don't lose your head. Just fucking start again. So we ended up with an arrangement that was just piano and vocals with Becky. We ended up with something I think I would argue is like way more powerful. And Jason's sort of coda or whatever at the end of that song where he's just playing piano and he sort of does this lead part. To me, you know, it's one of the best parts of the album. It's so natural. It just kind of happened. He just sort of, I told him vamp at the end and that's what he did, which is amazing. You can catch a take like that, you know. It's the solo on Blue as well. My friend Justin Lamb played the guitar on that. And that solo is just one straight take of him just fucking around. And it was like his second run through it, I think.
That's crazy.
That's the like lightning in a bottle moment. So you still get the lightning in a bottle moment. But like if you can go into it with this focused discipline at this age, 31, that's the best thing I've done so far. That's my feeling about it. But that's because I worked so hard on it, probably.
That's part of the learning, too, though.
Yeah. Like, well, yeah, and, like, even, like, I played the bass on the album, too, actually, which wasn't the original plan. Like, I had other people in mind to play bass that I had been talking to, and, like, you know, one day, like, I kind of needed this bass line, but I was like, well, it's a simple bass line, I can probably do it. And then, like, Charles, like, the engineer, Charles Austin, he was like, you know, you could probably just do the bass, you know, like, you know, and he sort of like coached me through it. So I knew what notes I needed to play and that kind of like stuff, but I'm not a bass player. But Charles is, like, he's a really great bass player. So he was like, I'll just sit with you and we'll figure it out together and I'll just like help you. So in doing that album, I also like learned how to play bass properly, like from like a physical standpoint, like, you know.
Where along the line did you decide you wanted to create music?
Honestly, the first thing, the very, very first thing was definitely like Elvis.
Yeah.
My grandmother on my mom's side, Nanny Marr, aka Carol, aka Mary, she was obsessed with Elvis. And like my parents both worked a lot when I was a kid, like, and Nan lived next door. So I was there all the time. So I got super into Elvis. Me and Nan used to watch Elvis movies till the cows came home. And like listen to Elvis records, dance around in the living room. And I was just obsessed with Elvis when I was a kid. So that was definitely the first thing that I was like aware of musically. My mom was really into like contemporary country at the time. So when I was really little, I really liked like, you know, Achy Breaky Heart and like shit like that. Like yeah. I was super into that stuff. That song is fire though. That's a sweet song. And then I was really into poetry when I was little. Like I used to write poems for the school, you know, for events and stuff. And I was like reading my poems at school assemblies. Like that was like who I was. That was my little identity. And then when I was in the fourth grade, I got Puff Daddy and the Family, No Way Out for Christmas, which is probably my favorite album of all time. Anyway, it just changed my whole life because it blew my mind. Like I didn't know hip hop before that. So it was like, I knew Elvis and I knew like contemporary country, but even as a kid, you can draw a through line. Like if you only know Elvis and then someone shows you Randy Travis, you'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, but in the fourth grade, knowing kind of only those two things and like, you know, whatever was on K100 at the time, you
right,
know,
yeah.
Like that's pretty much it. Hearing, you know, All About the Benjamins, right? If I could do anything for the first time in my life, again, it would probably be hearing All About the Benjamins for the first time. The whole concept of what music was suddenly opened all the way up.
Right.
Like it was like, it's not any particular thing. Cause that album, you know, it has all these skits. It has a narrative produced by Biggie, even though he was dead when it came out. Like a bunch of stuff on the album, like I'll Be Missing You is on the album. So there's stuff on the album about how he died. So when I was a kid, I was like, what? Like, I didn't understand how that made any sense, that he had executive produced an album about how he was dead. But of course, now I understand that like he had been working on it and while he was alive and blah, 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 blah. And then Puff definitely gave him like the executive producer credit because the album ended up being made in his honor.
Right.
You know, but I didn't understand that in the fourth grade. And then like the art was really cool. And like everybody that was on the album was standing on the cover in this huge lineup and they're all wearing these like crazy suits and they all look like mobsters. And it just, you know, it had these personas and this concept behind it. Like you put on an Elvis CD and you hear Elvis doing Elvis type music for 12 minutes. But if you put on No Way Out, you hear church bells and like steps in the rain and then this like really intense beat and then Puff Daddy, Busta Rhymes, and then Biggie, and then like an album skit. And then a completely different song that like samples an old song that's completely different vibe.
Right.
When I was a kid, it blew my fucking mind. And then my dad used to buy all these different tapes, like any mixtapes. It's like Grammy Rap Nominees 1999, which I still listen to all the time.
Yeah.
It had, so I just was like, this, whatever this is, this is what I'm doing forever. Like, that's how I felt as a kid. And then when My Name Is came out when I was in grade six, I saw the, like, Much Music premiere of My Name Is.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit, we're doing this. Like, we're definitely doing this. But, like, as a 11-year-old or whatever, seeing Eminem for the first time, I was like, oh, shit, yeah, like, anybody could do this. It's a, you know, like, you know, it's the music that I was listening to the whole time that I was figuring out, like, what art is, what music is, like, what being a musician is, like, all that.
Yeah.
And then when I was in high school, I had the same sort of experience with Nirvana, basically. I was staying at my brother's house on Duke Street going to summer school. This was, like, the heavy, like, internet piracy, like, early days. So
yeah.
He had all these, like, live performance videos, like, downloaded.
Oh, sweet.
On his computer. So he had this folder that was, like, all this sick live footage of, like, At the Drive-In and Marilyn Manson. But when I saw Nirvana Unplugged, that was, like, the moment where I felt like, you know, like, I could really write songs like this. You know, I was already kind of fucking around trying to learn guitar a little bit. Like, you know, Nirvana Unplugged, when that concert starts and he's playing About a Girl, as a 15-year-old that just knows like three chords, when you watch it, for my mind, it was like, oh shit, like you could definitely learn how to do what he's doing right now.
Oh yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like if you try hard enough, in a couple months, you can definitely play that song.
Yeah,
you
know? I definitely felt the same way.
And as soon as that happened, it was fucking like, it was off to the races, right? And I just always, that whole time, I just always liked writing. I've always written short stories, poetry, you know, I've written a ton of like personal essay style things. Like I've always kept a journal. I've kept different blogs over the years. Like I just like to write. So that's the thing that sort of glues it together for me, like any kind of writing, you know? Because then once it like, you know, when I got a little bit older and the first time I like started fucking around with rap music again and I was living on Elliott Row, you know, I was terrible, but I just started like, you know, dipping my foot in and fucking around. And then it wasn't until like when I was in Halifax in like 2010, I started fucking around with hip hop again. And I started to feel like maybe I had a little bit of a voice and like, you know, maybe I could make some good stuff. And I've always just floated back and forth, you know, Nirvana Unplugged to like sort of maybe feel that I could do it. But Heartbreaker sort of showed me how to do it. Like, you know, because it's country music, which I feel like a deep sort of connection to anyway. But it's not just like someone going through the motions of like just doing standard, like old country. Like this was a guy that came out of sort of the alt country scene of Whiskey Town and, you know, and that whole sort of Midwest 90s, like alt country movement. And sort of he was sort of looking at it from a different light. And it had that skit, like the album opens with a skit where they're arguing about a Morrissey song, which I thought was the coolest fucking thing, you know, ever when I first heard it. So it really gave me like focus and like a path. Like I feel like for me to write a good country song is very natural now. Like if you were to hold a gun to my head and say that I have to write like a very good country song right now, I'm pretty sure I could, you know, save my life, right? Like, cause I know I've been doing it for so long and I've done so much of it and it is at its core simplistic. That's what's good about it, right? Is
right,
that it's simple. Like to write a rap song, I have to write like eight times as much lyrics as I do. And like the lyrics have to be way more specifically mapped out, like in terms of the physicality of them.
Right. Yeah.
In a good rap verse, every syllable is accounted for and like placed correctly. But in a country song, like that's still true if you want it to be, but you can get away with some shit, and that's good. That's the nature of it.
No, I agree. Like, it's not as much to unpack when you're listening to it.
Yeah
You know, it might have a little bit to unpack.
Well, and you can do like you can do like complex narratives and stuff too, right? I just don't do that. Like when I'm writing, if I'm doing country, I like, my favorite shit is, like, George Jones. Like, to me, George Jones is, like, a perfect country musician. Not necessarily, he wasn't necessarily a perfect dude, but, you know, the music he made was, like, perfect.
I was a young guy living in the South End. I was too distressed. distracted by the beauty in your eyes to realize I was one of those guys. I followed your lightweight footsteps under the train bridge, broke some bottles, but I kept the ones we signed so that I share a drink with you. I was a smart guy. I dressed pretty well. I was too distracted by people I despise to realize I was one of those guys. I bought some pretty cheap bottles, busted open, sipped on slowly, but I kept the one you signed so that I would remember you. Second you said goodbye, so much time spent online reading about you, writing about you, sleeping in, going on.
Welcome back to the Pagan Place. Here, let me chop up that poison for you. No, you keep the tip. All we need is a little like and share. That'll do just fine. There you go. Have a good day.
Casey Musgraves, to me, is like a superhero to me, because she is making country music that's very modern, and it's very like, right. It is a step forward, and like, it's inventive and interesting. But it's very much fucking country music.
Oh yeah. It's very true to form.
It's like very hard to, make like music that's like, you hear it and you're like, that's fucking country music. That isn't sort of old fashioned.
Yeah.
And I don't think her records are old fashioned at all. Like, no, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, not in content, certainly, but like in the fucking writing of the songs, like, they're so clever, and the melodies are like unbelievably beautiful, and like the arrangements are really nice, and like, obviously the players are good, and like, she plays with genre successfully, which is like rare, you know, like a lot of times when you hear someone in country music sort of playing with genre, it's kind of a novelty. Yeah. Or it's funny. But she's like fucking around with genre boundaries. You know, she has her own lane. And it's inventive, and it's incredible to see, right? Cooking has the same issue where there's certain people that are like traditionalists.
Yeah.
And then they're the people that oppose them. But like, tradition isn't static. To have a tradition doesn't mean that you have never changed anything about it since it began. Like, that's not the thing. I don't, like, it shouldn't be, right? And there's a lot of chefs that argue that. Like, Massimo Bottura argues that all the time, because he's an Italian chef. But his argument, of course, is like, if we want it to be a living, breathing, you know, cultural tradition that's a part of our lives, we have to build on it.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just going to be in a museum.
Well, the culture itself changes. Like,
yeah.
So you kind of have to...
The ingredients change. people change, like the entire context of the meal. Like food is like literally everything else. Like we have a connection to it that goes beyond like needing to be alive, because it's just part of like the like cultural system that we've built. But there's like some people argue that cooking is like the whole reason humans exist at all. I'm not an expert about this, obviously, but you know, there is a reasonable argument to be made that like the discovery of fire leading directly into cooking, there's no doubt that it drastically altered, you know, what we were as beings, right? But when you start looking at like how much more time existed in the day all of a sudden, because before you could cook, like the amount of time you spent chewing was obviously like way more, that's right? True. And the amount of like being able to preserve food, and cooking also like is able to like break down nutrients in a way that your body can process more nutrients. So you could argue that like our like larger brain size might have a lot to do with our ability to process nutrients faster, things like that, right?
Agriculture.
Yeah, like agriculture. It totally and then there's changed, the community aspect of like sitting down to a meal.
Yeah.
Like preparing something and then sitting down as a group, you know, as like a base concept to build society on.
Mm.
So, you know, you can make that argument.
Food is just as much of an art as music.
Anything can be creative, I guess, if you want to go about it in a creative way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any job, like anything that you do, you can be creative every day. And like, but food is like music in the way that like our connection to it is like entirely emotional. Like there's a reason people don't just eat nutrition mush every day.
Oh, yeah. You enjoy it. You
Yeah, it's part of your like.
You look forward to certain meals because you had turkey dinner as a kid and
yeah.
Turkey was delicious and your family was there and everyone was happy. You have all these associations with...
The plate is your flag, basically. So it's like, which is true. Like it is sort of like breaking it down beyond where you are and like what your nationality is or whatever. You know, your traditional food sort of does tell a lot about like your story, where you're from,
oh, absolutely.
And,
like, yeah,
where your family's from, things like that, right? And the food things cultures. That your comfort food is like really specific, you know, like, you know, my comfort food being like grilled cheese and tomato soup, for example, is something that's like very, you know, specific. So it is like, you know, you build all this stuff around it. Like the dining is all about nostalgia, I feel like.
Yeah, I think so.
Because otherwise you would just eat the cheapest thing that had the most nutrients all the time.
There's the time that I dine out to explore something. You know, if a new place opens up, they got some new thing. But usually when I go to those places, after I've been there, I know what I like. I get what I like.
But even beyond that, right? Like if you're writing a menu for anyone to consume, nostalgia is always going to be a part of that process. So before you even know what you're eating at the restaurant, like you and the chef have agreed that nostalgia is going to be involved. Cause it's like when you go to a menu, like you're always going to see certain things that you recognize and identify with based on where you are and like what we grow and like what's seasonal here and things like that.
Yeah.
There's also like flavor combinations that work on this like really like base like human nostalgia level, and a lot of like the creativity in food is using these like flavor profiles and like flavor combinations that evoke a certain feeling or pleasure in the guest to like that at a base level of like what is really important. There's certain things that like, you know, chicken and thyme taste good and they always will, you know what I mean?
Like, right.
Like, even beyond that, like, strawberry and balsamic is always going to work. There's certain things that grilled cheese and tomato soup is always going to be a perfect meal. Like, it just makes sense. It has all the things you need.
Yeah.
You know? Except something pickled. It's good to have something pickled nearby.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important to talk about your restaurant, too, because...
Sure, yeah.
I think that's part of your creative process, obviously.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, your thoughts about what you're talking about right now. So how does that translate into you putting together what your presentation, you know, is going to be, your menu?
Like the concept and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, my company is really built on nostalgia. Like that's the whole, like our tagline is somewhat refined nostalgia. So you have that like, you know, that's on our window. So you have that kind of concept going in, right?
Yeah.
But I do think that like most of dining is about nostalgia and like reworking things that people, you know, feel good about beyond just it not being gross, you know? But my concept is really built around that because, you know, it's named after my grandmothers, who have both passed on. So obviously it's personal and it's family focused and like both of my grandmothers were sort of the matriarch of their like respective families. So it's built around that concept of sort of providing someone with as close an experience as you can to going to your nan's house and getting a bowl of soup. But that being said, our focus is to get as close to that as possible, while taking the craft of the food very seriously and like really focusing in on like what we're doing, why we're doing it, where we are in the world, what time of the year it is, what's available locally, what is the environmental impact of the food that we make. I'm not going to serve any meat in the restaurant that I don't know like where it came from and right. What happened when it was a living animal. That's where I draw the line. But yeah, I want it to be homey and comfortable, but I don't want to be another place that just serves you something that you could just have stayed at home to eat. We're going to have beef stew, but my beef stew is like a slow braised red wine, beautiful local beef stew. Right. So it's still going to be just beef and gravy and veggies. But if you take time and I have been doing it a very long time, I don't think that I'm like a brilliant cook or anything, but I'm doing it long enough and I care enough that like if you get the right ingredients and you work really hard and you really care about what you're doing and you have a little bit of creativity and, you know, stew can be mind-blowingly good, you know?
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Beef bourguignon is my favorite dish in the world, like to make and eat. It's just a perfect thing. It's my favorite thing. That with a piece of good bread, just like the best thing in the world.
So it kind of ties into what you were saying about how with country music or, you mm-hmm. know, any of our arts, you're leaving its roots where it is, but yeah. You're kind of...
Gabriel Hamilton said this thing in Mind of a Chef about the custodial role that you can play when you're using tradition. Because her restaurant in New York, Prune, they're very much about tradition. She sort of wanted to be the custodian of that. And I think about that all the time now because I feel that way as well about like, there's certain like sort of traditional New Brunswick stuff and like even products like that are like abundant and that we really should be eating and dishes that just are so New Brunswick that even though like there has to be people out there trying new stuff all the time and using influences from other places and stuff like that. In my capacity as a restaurant owner, I'm pretty comfortable going the route of being more of like a custodian of tradition while also sort of injecting some real like sort of discipline and thought into stuff rather than taking it for granted. Like we're not trying to like introduce a new concept of food, obviously.
Yeah.
But we do want people to feel like, God damn, this is like the best stew I ever had. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's really the goal. Or like even like to have a piece of bread and be like, shit, this is like a really good loaf of bread, like, you know, or pie or anything.
So it sounds like it's a lot like even how you talked about how you wrote your last album, just sort of focus in on why is this thing a good thing? What can I do to add to that good thing or make it better or, you know?
Exactly. I mean, you know, that's why our menu's a chalkboard too, right? Because it's like partly because, it cuts down on waste and there's all kinds of like really practical reasons why you'd have a chalkboard menu. But it also like allows you to rework stuff if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
If I spend 2 months planning my spring menu and then I print it, like you can still miss stuff.
Mm.
In my experience in restaurants anyway, like in the process of like setting up a menu, you know, maybe the availability of a product changes and then you gotta like change it slightly. But then when you change something, you know, if you can't get a certain protein and then you're trying to change an entree based on like a different protein, like some other element of the dish probably at that point isn't going to work either.
Right. Yeah.
So you have to kind of tweak it to make it work. And if you have to rewrite your menu every time you have to do that, it boxes you in. If you have a printed menu, no matter what, or even like a seasonal menu where like you have one menu for like 3 or 4 months at a time, it does kind of box you in and it puts you in a situation where like you might have to buy product that you wouldn't necessarily want to support otherwise.
Right.
Because a farmer is a person that works you know, an excruciating job and doesn't get paid enough to do a base human job that has to exist. Like, it's an extremely difficult job that we desperately need people to do. So, you know, to do it the hard way still, because it would be a lot. There's a reason why there's not as many sort of hobby farms. Like, there's a reason people don't do it. It's extremely difficult. Like, I have friends that farm. Like, my friend Jamie Reynolds is a great vegetable farmer that I get stuff from all the time. And, like, he works his ass off. If I saw somebody put his name on their menu and when they were, like, actually selling some shit from Cisco, I'd fucking lose it. I'd be so mad. So, you know, you shouldn't do that. It does matter. So you're stuck in a box anyway, is what I'm saying. It's like you put yourself in a position where people expect this menu item to be there every time and you can't get the good product. So that's what happens. That's why that happens so much. For us, you know, if something doesn't work on that menu, we just wipe it off. And,
yeah,
you know, if we have a week sometime where there's just no meat, I don't have a problem with that. If to be sustainable and locally focused and support our farmers, we have to sometimes be a vegetarian restaurant for a couple of days. I don't think that's a big deal. I don't see why that never happens. Like, this is where we are in human history. Like, we destroyed agriculture. Like, that's just the way it is. Like, we completely screwed it up. Agriculture is broke. There's no infrastructure right now for a person to start a farm, to make great products, to get it to a restaurant, to put on a plate. There's someone standing in your way every step.
Yeah.
If you're trying to be locally focused and, like, support farmers in your restaurant, it's very difficult to do because the infrastructure is gone. Here, I mean, specifically, like, I'm talking about St. John. Yeah.
When I split my kids, I am on proud of my chin drops. But I shouldn't have to reason with myself. So unreasonable with yourself. I can never live. I'm not allowed to be the boss. But I made my mind up by myself. Make it up to all of us in hell. Tell me when you need it. You shouldn't get to know me before you leave me. Convenient that you're leaving. Tell me what you needed. I don't know how I've been stuck for so long. She says she's gonna leave me still. I can tell she's serious. I can tell she's serious. She's serious. Thank you.
So how hard is it for you to try to source as much as you can from New Brunswick?
It's hard.
It's
there's only one licensed abattoir in all of New Brunswick.
Oh, shit.
So in theory, if you think about it, if you want to serve a dead animal in New Brunswick, there's one building near Sussex that had to gone through for it to be local.
Wow.
And that's a fucking huge problem because there's lots of farmers out there that have all these great products, but it's hard for you to use them because if they're not being processed in that licensed abattoir that's inspected by the Food Inspection Agency, then it's not legal for you to serve it.
Right.
So that creates this whole other issue where we have all this amazing product in New Brunswick that we just aren't using. Like in Newfoundland, they're set up very differently. In Newfoundland, if you want to, you can shoot a moose and serve it in your restaurant. And that's why they're having a culinary moment, because there's this guy, Jeremy Charles, is a chef there whose book, Wildness, I recently bought, is amazing. He's a hunter as well and a fisherman, and so he can serve wild game in his restaurant. Huh. And we can't do that here at all.
Crazy.
And we have an abundance of venison, for example, that's like,
yeah,
it's insane that you don't see deer on any menus around here.
Yeah, it's super rare. Like,
I had venison when I was in Moncton last, like when I was up for Eating Heritage, I had venison. But like, yeah, you don't fucking see it at all. And it's like, they're fucking everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, they're everywhere.
We're almost overwhelmed with it.
Right? Yeah, like, you know, St. Andrews had that whole issue this year with them. So
yeah.
It's a problem because if you do want to serve venison here, you have to find a venison farm. And to my knowledge, if someone knows a place that I can buy farmed venison in New Brunswick, please tell me. But to my knowledge, you can only get it from, like, a hunter friend of yours.
Yeah.
Like, from within New Brunswick, I'm
saying. Right.
And so that, you know, that's just weird. And, like, things like that rabbit, really you don't see weird. Rabbit. And, like, you know, we have them. It's very frustrating because you do have this sort of red tape. And nobody is, like, the food safety people aren't, like, trying to make your life harder. You know what I mean? It's just that the system is broken because right. of greedy people doing evil things. Just like every single aspect of society right now. It's like rich people ruined it.
That makes me wonder how difficult it would be to start up another processing plant to have it, you know.
Yeah, I think about it all the time. Because the thing is, like, I would never want to affect them negatively. They're called the Country Butcher outside of Sussex. They have great products and they're awesome. And I would never want to go about it in a way that, like, negatively affected their business. But I do think that there's enough demand right now that you could justify the existence of another one for sure, just to facilitate more farmers being able to get their products out to you.
Yeah, that just blows my mind, and I had no idea.
You know, it's very complicated because really, like, every aspect of it is geared towards just running a fast food place.
Oh, yeah.
You know
what
I mean? Like, all of the system is built so that you can buy a Subway franchise and open it. And operate it every day without hurting anyone and at a profit. Like, that is how the whole system is built.
Right.
And the entire agricultural system is built around Loblaws, like the way the Loblaws works.
Right.
So we're, you know, even though we can grow a bunch of these things here, we're getting them from elsewhere, which is, like, environmentally irresponsible and also unsustainable and also less good for you.
Right.
And, like, of lower quality. So yeah. it's very stressful trying to do it.
But you need people that are trying these things, right? You're putting your hat in the race. And if nobody did that, absolutely nothing would change.
Oh, man. Right? So, and I mean, honestly, like, the people that own, seriously, if you're listening to this, the people that own these little shops in St. John, the amount of work and difficulty to go into an old-ass building in Uptown St. John and get the paperwork and renovate something to the place where you can, like, put a business in it that you're not going to make a bunch of money from. Seriously, I hope people appreciate, like, I'm not trying to get people to appreciate me. I'm just, like, starting, you know what I mean? But imagine if, like, places like Scheherazade didn't exist in St. John, or Loyalist City Coin. If these places didn't exist in Uptown St. John, the difference culturally of, like, quality of life here.
Substantial.
You know what I mean? And, like, places like Bella's and Vegilution and, like, all these great places, it's hard to do it, man. It's really hard.
Oh, it is. So where can people find your album?
It's on my Bandcamp exclusively for now. If you buy the album, I'm giving it, you know, a couple months or whatever, but if you buy the album from me on Bandcamp, all the money I'm just going to give to the North End Food Bank. So that's why it's not on streaming services right now. Down the road, I'll put it on Spotify and stuff. You can listen to it for free, but if you like to download it, it's pay what you can, or you can make a donation to the food bank. totally up to you. But yeah, davidrelliott.bandcamp.com.
And I'll have a link in the description as well, so yeah, people can just click that.
Yeah, and there's a whole whack of albums on that Bandcamp if you got a rainy day and you're bored. But the new album's called Common Street, and it's my favorite thing I ever made.
Yeah, it's a really good album. I like it a lot.
Thank you, man.
Anything you wanted to mention or throw out there?
All I really want to say, I think, is that like Common Street is a really focused and passionate love letter to St. John. And there's a lot of like really specific St. John stuff in there, and sort of characters and stuff. I don't really care what happens to it as long as people in St. John, like, this is my musical attempt at honoring the legacy of Alden Nolan, basically.
Awesome.
That's what I'll say about that. So give it a quick listen.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Thanks for coming in, man.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Yeah, man. Yeah, it was fun.
So living on Murder Row, back in old 2008, in the olden days. Walking home, I see the fire's on, sidewalk all in rows. No one knows I'm in love with this feeling. It's appealing, it's where I wanna go. No one knows. Sails at my window, breaking the back door, bring on the snow. Carmarthen, you're my horizon. And your roses, where I've been, where I'm going. Thank you.
Hey, it's your girl Mel Sears, and you've been listening to the Pagan Place podcast.